Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 46, we dissect one of the darkest days in US soccer history. We reveal which legendary commentator has joined NBC Sports to boost their Premier League coverage, what Fox Sports has in store for the penultimate day of the MLS season, and much more. Plus, we have tons of letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, aka The Gaffer, and I'm joined today by Kartik Krishnaiyer. Kartik, okay, this is kind of a big sigh and a big deep breath, but there's a lot to take in, a lot to discuss in this episode, but I'm actually going to go backwards. So I'm going to rather than focus on what happened last night right away, I want to talk about what we've been watching prior to that, prior to the Tuesday night meltdown in terms of the last week, and then we'll get to the U.S. Trinidad game and everything revolving around that shortly. So let's kick it off with you, Kartik, in terms of what you've been watching this past week.
Yeah, I lament international breaks. I complain about them. I get angry and distant about them. Chris, I have probably in years not watched as much football as I did this week. And that might be a reflection of our featured topic last week, where there are more and more non-competitive games, not just in the Premier League, but around Europe and in the top leagues and in Major League Soccer. There are games that are 4-0 and 3-0 games as well. So And even in NASL and USL. So let's start with me. I'll just go through these real quickly because I watch so much football. Northern Ireland, Germany. I had high hopes for Northern Ireland to potentially win this game and put pressure on Germany for that automatic qualification spot. It was no contest. Germany, as always, when they're up against it and need a result, put the opposition to the sword. This match in Belfast on FS2, Northern Ireland ends up having to go to the playoffs now to qualify. Colombia, Paraguay, which was on BN. Watch this. David Ospina made two incredible errors that kept the door open for Paraguay and put Colombia's qualification in doubt. Now, the thing is, there's so much that's happened this week, Chris. This was a monumental result at the time we watched it. It now, looking back, didn't mean anything because Paraguay didn't take advantage of the opportunity, did not beat Venezuela, and Colombia went to Lima, got the result they needed. They qualified for the World Cup automatically. The next morning, India and the U.S. In the FIFA U-17 World Cup, a really good performance from India, given the talent gap between them and the United States. They're the home team, they're the host country. The U.S., as usual, at the youth level, looks stacked. But as we've seen time and again, something happens with these kids between the ages, the 16 to 18, when they're excelling at the U20 and U17 and U20 level. And by the time they get to the senior national team, there are a few that have continued their steady growth. Most U.S. players excel at the youth level and then drop off. And they drop off quickly. By the time they're at the U23 level or the full national team level, they're not relative to the international competition at the same standard. So before people get too excited about how well the U.S. U-17 team is playing in India, and they are playing well, and they look really good, think about that. And that would be my same observation from the England-Chile game from a few days later, where England has had the same sort of thing. They won the U-20 World Cup even this year, a tournament which the U.S. was also very good in. And I'm seeing Dominic Calvert-Lewin, who was a star of that team, Tammy Abraham, who was a star of that team. Those guys, yeah, they're okay in the Premier League, but they haven't taken that next step. So hopefully they can. Let's keep going. Mexico, Trinidad, and Tobago. U.S. Panama, obviously, from Orlando. ESPN's coverage was very good. Maybe we can discuss this more later. This game now seems like it was years ago, given what's happened since. So
yeah, it was really kind of a breath of fresh air, this one, because with having Max Bretos hosting it, in terms of the production, in terms of the talking points, how well Twelman did in terms of analyzing this match, Ian Dark, it felt like the boys were back, and it was a really great broadcast. And of course, the performance and victory was, at the time, fantastic. But it was one of those games, I think that Panama completely just miscalculated tactically.
Came out wanting to attack, which was bizarre. I think they felt like they probably needed to get a point in this game because their feeling was that the U.S. would get results, get a result in Trinidad, and obviously that didn't happen. It's amazing international football, the swings in CONMEBOL and in CONCACAF the last few days. A little less so in UEFA. There weren't any massive qualifying rallying stunners, other than, and I hate to bring this up, but Ireland catching Wales and passing them by beating them. But we'll get to that in a few minutes.
Two more things just about this game real fast, Kartik, is that it was nice to see Sam Borden as ESPN's global soccer correspondent on the set. He was only on there for a short time, but it was nice to see him just because I'm getting a little bit sick of seeing Grant Wall everywhere, and Sam had some good points to share. I also really enjoyed Sebastian Salazar and kind of the sideline reporter giving his insight in terms of Panama, what the team was thinking, and the Panamanian president being at the stadium and adding that side. And that was valuable, I thought.
Yeah, I think as we enter a new era of U.S. soccer, hopefully, and we'll discuss this in our feature topic, we're going to spend much of the podcast, if not most of it, on this. I think Seb Salazar is a guy who's going to emerge as a star in the new world when those who observe the U.S. men's national team and the game in this country are mired in reality and not in the alternate reality that they have been for the last few years. But we'll get to that in a few minutes. Mexico TNT, good performance from a young, kind of experimental Trinidad and Tobago side. They didn't have the fitness, though, to keep it going. Outplayed Mexico probably for about 70 minutes. Were actually leading in the game at that point, 1-0, and lost their legs late at the altitude. And again, young players, poor conditioning for a lot of them. Dennis Lawrence calling in a lot of guys from their domestic league, which is basically an amateur league. They lose 3-1. Yet those same amateur players would have their day in the sun a few days later, which we will get to. And I know everybody listening is aware of that. Bosnia-Belgium, the next day, John Champion, Craig Burley on ESPN News. Anyone who starts – and when I had this argument on Twitter and Facebook when the U.S. was manufacturing its excuse making of 24 to 48 hours before the debacle in Port of Spain or debacle in Trinidad, I pointed to this game and said, look, you're saying, oh, in Europe, you have to get used to CONCACAF. You know how difficult it is in CONCACAF, these hotshot European teams, Chris Arena, they couldn't come to CONCACAF. Belgium had to play on this pitch, which was one of the worst pitches I've ever seen. The stadium was a cauldron of noise, which it wasn't in Trinidad. Loud, aggressive fans, which you often get in the Balkans and in Eastern Europe, for those CONCACAF apologists who want to believe that Europe is some kind of cakewalk, because there seem to be a lot of those. Because I was stunned by the number of people coming at me on social media defending Bruce Arena's comments. This was unbelievable, the pitch they played on. Yet Belgium got four goals. It was a classic back-and-forth game, 4-3. I did not figure out the right terminology to describe that pitch. Taylor Twellman, in his now epic rant from Tuesday night, described it as a cow pasture. That is correct. Belgium wins nonetheless. Begovic made some really good shot stops for Bosnia, but also has made several mistakes in terms of distribution and when to come off his line. So that was that game. I watched Portland-Orlando, as much of it as I could. It was going on at the same time as two big college football games in the state, Miami-FSU and LSU-Florida.
Kartik, when you mentioned Portland-Orlando, we should mention that's the NWSL semifinal.
Oh, yeah, right. Not the MLS version of those two teams. Yeah, it was a very really crisp broadcast on Lifetime. I'm so impressed by their production level. They brought Julie Foudy in, obviously. Dale Culf is there, and you've got Ali Wagner and Jen Hildreth doing such a good job presenting. They have grown as a broadcast team through the course of the season, and I just felt like this was presented in a manner that a lot of times you don't see MLS games presented in. It was just very professional, very crisp, obviously a network with a lot of resources. It was a tough one for Orlando. They just never were in the game. There was a period of time where Tom Sermonti, their manager, had them press high. They got it back to 2-1, but Portland really bossed this game, and I'm looking forward to the final, which I'm still contemplating whether I'm going to be there or not, but the final is Saturday in Orlando mm-hmm. between Portland and North Carolina, and I would urge our listeners to watch that if they like women's football.
Kartik, one thing, I haven't watched a lot of NWSL this season, a lot of other games going on, of course, but like you, I was really impressed with the production of this, and it's amazing too, because this is Lifetime's first season doing NWSL, first season doing soccer. Just blew me away in terms of how well it was done.
Yeah, and I think they've probably hired soccer people to help them with production, which some other people who broadcast soccer don't do. That would be my takeaway from that. Chile, England. It's impossible to overstate how good England looked. This is a U-17 World Cup game that was on FS1. But again, like I said with the U.S., something happens between the U-17/U-20 levels and the senior national team with English players, much like it happens with American players. So don't get too excited yet. Slovenia, Scotland, this was a massive disappointment for me personally. I didn't expect Scotland to get the result here, but when they took the lead in the game, I felt like they were in good shape and would be able to consolidate and see the game out, and they didn't. And so they are out for the 10th straight consecutive major tournament, and this is the threat to the U.S. we'll talk about. The U.S. can go in a couple different directions. The doomsday scenario for the United States is that we end up being Scotland. And before people laugh that off, just remember how you felt last night. And you don't want to be in that position. I remember when Scotland missed the Euro 2000 tournament, lost in a playoff to England, people thought, what we'll do is we'll just go out, we'll hire Bertie Vogts, we'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And you just saw a general drift away from players playing in that league. All sorts of things happened. We will get into it later. Mexico-Iraq was a U-17 game I watched. That was a really good game. Iraq pulled out a draw. Mark Rogondino on the call with Mariano Rivera. Very crisp. Rivera knows the young Mexican players pretty well. Norway, Northern Ireland, John Champion and Craig Burley. Northern Ireland disappointed me in this match. They created a lot of chances, weren't able to score, lost 1-0, but they still qualified for the playoffs. Ghana, USA, the next morning on FS1. The rivalry, if you want to call it that, continues, although now both team countries have missed the Senior World Cup, so they will not meet for the fourth straight Senior World Cup, but they seem to always be grouped together, even in youth tournaments. The U.S. wins in the end. I have to mention that the young man who scored the goal, whose name is escaping me, was first scouted by Marcelo Castillo, who I worked with both the Fort Lauderdale Strikers and then Boca Raton FC when he was the head coach. Wikipedia even gives him credit for discovering the player and alerting U.S. soccer that he was eligible to play for the United States. He's Canadian. He could play for U.S. or Canada. And obviously, for those who don't know, when you get capped at the youth level, it does not mean you can't switch back before the age of 21 to the other national team. So I'm sure Canada will be ringing his phone. He is in Toronto FC's academy, by the way. Then Wales, Ireland. Maybe I'll save this for Chris. Look, the thing I will say about this is, and it's unfortunate for Wales, we know at the club level, except at the end at Sunderland, what a good manager Martin O'Neill was. He has consistently, in games with Republic of Ireland since he's taken over, gotten the clutch result when he needed it against Germany in Euro 2016 qualifying, in the playoff then, against Germany to get into the playoff. He had to beat Germany. And I remember thinking, Scotland's going to be in the playoff. And no, they win that game, Republic of Ireland. And then the playoff, they get it. Then they start terribly in the group stage of the Euros, the best team in the entire tournament. And I think the takeaway from the Euros is, even though Portugal won it, Italy under Conte was the best team in the entire tournament. Ireland needs 3 points, and they beat them. And now this, where they had lost at home to Serbia in Dublin, and I had given them up. For those who don't know, I support the Republic of Ireland as my second national team behind the U.S., and I had given them up for dead after that match. Mm-hmm. I did not expect this, but he made a couple of clutch calls, particularly starting James McLean, who ended up getting the goal. Cyrus Christie is a young right back who has he's kept in the team and let him play through his mistakes. A championship level player. because of the injury to Seamus Coleman, and he had a blinder in this game. So hats off to Martin O'Neill, just really a high-end manager. And I hate to say this, Chris, I think you saw the difference between O'Neill and Coleman.
I think definitely Ireland did well in this one in terms of they're not a very good team, but in terms of defense,
no, they're not, and that's why you need a good manager.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, and defensively they were sound. I mean, in terms of, but Wales kind of played into their game. A lot of long balls that were easy for Ireland to defend and head away. It was one of those games that really, at the end of the day, the result, I think it was a fair result. Wales just didn't show up for this game. There were some mistakes that they made, but also there were chances, but just a really great performance from Ireland, especially at home. Playing away in Cardiff, it was a very difficult atmosphere.
Yeah, they got points in Vienna, they got points in Cardiff, and they got points in Belgrade, which is remarkable. I mean, that's worthy of qualifying for a World Cup and sets you up in direct contrast to what we saw from the United States, where they can't get points where they need to get points.
Yeah, speaking of the atmosphere, I mean, to me, I mean, I'm biased, of course. I was born in Wales, have a British passport, but also I'm an American citizen. But that was the loudest national anthem I can ever remember hearing for a soccer game when the Welsh... the entire stadium were belting out Hit Vlad and Hadai.
The only comparable comparison I remember was when Republic of Ireland played France in the first leg of the playoff in 2009. The second leg has obviously become infamous because of the Henry handball. The first leg was at Croke Park, not at Lansdowne Road. It was at Croke Park, the rugby ground. Was moved to a bigger ground, and I remember the same effect with the national anthem there. Mm-hmm. Although I have to say, Neil Blackman and I have commented on this. We were at the U.S. Martinique game over the summer. When you hear the French national anthem, you feel like you should run through walls when you hear that. It's such a belligerent, militant song.
Absolutely.
So there is some effect when France plays home matches as well on that. But, yeah, I completely agree. The atmosphere in Cardiff for this entire match was amazing.
Yeah.
And, Chris, let me ask you this. Is Wales adopting football as its sport now? Is rugby and Gaelic football on the wane?
Well, Gaelic football is not nowhere to be found. But as far as rugby is still by leaps and bounds much, much bigger than soccer still is. But the thing of the irony about this, Kartik, was that that this was Wales's only defeat in all of World Cup qualifying, and they're out. So it just goes to show you how difficult the group was. They played well all the way up to this last game. They did okay in this game, but just Ireland was that much better. Just one loss, and they're out. So
right. And for those people who are arguing with me, taking the company line of Bruce Arena, that somehow the U.S. would be better off in Europe and they could finish second in every group, you're crazy. Because look at there's no margin for error there. You could say there's margin for error in CONMEBOL because of the way it's structured, but the margin for error is you're just playing better teams, right, than you do in CONCACAF. So you can't win just two or three games in qualifying like the U.S. did and go through. That's a topic for later. ESPN FC that night, though, because Arena made his comments, was one of the – it was almost like a comedy show between Bruce Arena and Gordon Strachan and everything in between. I mean, they did get down to having a serious discussion about Argentina in between, and Burley – very matter-of-factly said that he felt like Argentina would win because their backs were against the wall and they had Messi, and he would will them to victory, and he was right. Messi was – if you didn't watch that game, Messi, you talk about putting a team of guys that have no putting them on your back. I don't want to call it a solo virtuoso performance, but it was pretty close. Mm-hmm. Again, reinforcing the greatness of Lionel Messi. But it was just a hilarious show between Arena's comments about the pitch and hotshot European teams. And Burley said, well, the real mystery is whether the Germany C team could come over to CONCACAF and win the X. He thinks they might. Mm-hmm. So not even the Germany B team, the Germany C team. That it was just a ridiculous comment. Everyone agreed. Hercules Gomez took a bit of a different perspective. He agreed it was a ridiculous comment. But what Hercules thought was that it was an effort to deflect pressure off his players because they were feeling the pressure. And maybe he was right, because we saw how much stage fright the U.S. had the next night. But that was Gomez's take, was that, yeah, it's an absurd comment, but Bruce was saying the most absurd thing he could in order to take the pressure off of his players. And then there's the Gordon Strachan comment about genetics, which really bears no need in analysis. Burley, as a Scotsman who played in the last World Cup they qualified for, was just put out. Finishing up real quickly, India Colombia on FS2, late Colombian winner to win 2-1 in New Delhi in the U17s. Brazil North Korea, again, a really good U17 game. It's amazing how the Brazilians recycle names like Paulinho and Kleberson and et cetera and stick them on young footballers. They all seem to have familiar names. Portugal, Switzerland. I thought the Rob Stone pregame show on Fox was pretty good, but the game itself underwhelmed. But it was interesting this week. We saw so much of Stu Holden in Fox's studios and around Fox's World Cup game, a World Cup qualifying games. We did not see much of Alexi Lalas or any of Eric Winalda. So I don't know what that indicates for the World Cup coming up. We know Holden will not be in the studio during the World Cup. He will be in the booth with John Strong, but he's taken on a major studio presence. This whole I want to say he worked every day during European qualifying, at least, and was certainly there for Scotland, Slovenia, and disappointed. For those who don't know, obviously Holden is a star U.S. player, but actually Scottish roots, born in Scotland. So he was disappointed by that. Then Ecuador, Argentina, and the CONMEBOL games, and of course, culminating in TNT USA. And I don't really want to say much more about that game.
Yeah, it's interesting, Kartik, because Fox Sports hasn't televised a U.S. men's national team game, a big game, like an actual meaningful game, since the Gold Cup final at the end of July. So for the past several months, it's been the big games have been on, even the Gold Cup qualifiers have been on ESPN or RBN Sports. And now also with the U.S. not being in the World Cup and with the U.S. unlikely to play some friendlies in the next month, there's no rush to start setting up some games until probably we can find a new coach. We're probably not going to see that many games from the U.S. on Fox.
Yeah, so just for those who don't remember this, the U.S. did not play a game between the end of the 2006 World Cup, when Bruce Arena was fired, and January 2007, when Bob Bradley was kind of in a rush job, given the interim tag of two. He had been brought in to coach the U.S. U-23 team. I suspected he would be the full national team coach at the time, because you don't leave an MLS job, which is what he did, as arguably the top coach in that league to coach the U-23 U.S. team. But it was however many months that was, 8 months. I don't know if the U.S., after this failure — we thought the World Cup 2006 was a failure at the time and blow it up, blah, blah, blah. But this is certainly far worse than that. That was obviously coming off a cycle where the U.S. had won the hex and were ranked in the top 10 in the FIFA world rankings. And it was just because the weight of expectations were so great in the World Cup, and they were put in a group of death. Mm-hmm. They didn't advance, but they went 8 months without playing a game, or however many months that would be, 7 to 8 months without playing a match. I don't think they can afford to go that long without playing at least a friendly. I don't know that there's an interim coach, though, you can put in place, because everybody who is on that staff is associated with Bruce in one way or another. So,
Well, maybe Peter Vermes or something like that, a temporary coach that goes in, you mean, towards the end of the year, that's after the MLS season's over, and it plays a friendly, you mean, in December or January or something like that, just to keep the players fresh.
Yeah, they're going to have that January camp. I don't know. It's a whole new world. The old rules are out, I guess.
Absolutely. So just to run through what I've seen this past week, I saw the England-Slovenia. Actually, the first few games I saw were just incredibly boring last week, and that was England-Slovenia, that felt like a 0-0 but ended up being a 1-0 with Harry Kane scoring the late goal. I watched Bolivia against Brazil, another 0-0. Venezuela-Uruguay, another 0-0. And then got to watch Georgia against Wales. Fox had advertised that this was going to be on FS2, but the U17 game preempted the coverage of the game, so they bumped Georgia against Wales to Fox Deportes. So I watched that through Fubo instead.
Which U17 game was it? Was that the U.S. game?
I think it was the U.S. game. Yeah, it was It was the tail end of the India-USA game. On FS1, they had a baseball pregame show. So that had bumped Colin Cowherd to FS2, and then that ended up bumping Georgia Wales to Fox Deportes. So the frustrating thing with that is just like lack of communication from Fox to let us know what was going on. We had to find out the hard way. Similar thing happened also, I understand, for the Bulgaria-France game over the weekend, which was supposed to be on the FS2, but was bumped to Fox Sports Go and replaced with a college football game. Next up was Ireland against Moldova, and then I watched Turkey against Iceland. The US-Panama game, I already mentioned that one. Portland-Orlando mentioned that one too. And Wales and Ireland, of course, mentioned that one. And last but not least, the Netherlands against Sweden, which we had Steve Banyard and Stuart Robson on that one. But Netherlands are out. In terms of Tuesday night, the non-US games, I did watch parts of the Ecuador-Argentina game and also watched parts of the Peru-Colombia game. And I was actually, my daughter's had a soccer practice, so I was watching that, I think at a Starbucks, using the Fubo app on that. So Kartik, let's talk about the U.S. Trinidad and Tobago game. But I want to start off in terms of the television coverage first before we talk about the actual game itself and what it means. But I watched it on beIN Sports. The challenge that a lot of Americans had last night in the United States was for those who didn't have beIN Sports on their television network and wanted to watch it online. There were huge issues online. Fubo had crashed. Go 90 was up and down. Sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't work. Sling TV did work for the most part. So I was able to watch the game on Sling TV from the Starbucks and watched it that way. But just a really frustrating night. The other thing that's frustrating to me about beIN Sports' coverage of the World Cup qualifiers is that they had 8 of the 8 games that were airing at basically the same time on Tuesday night. So you had 5 games from CONMEBOL and 3 from CONCACAF. Out of the 5 from CONMEBOL, every single one of those had implications on qualifying. And with beIN Sports not having that many, well, one, not having distribution, 22 million homes, but not having any partnerships where they could say, okay, let's do a partnership with, I don't know, CBS, and have CBS show one of the big games on their network. It's just a, to me, a really difficult situation for soccer fans in the United States when beIN Sports has so many of the rights. Yes, some of those CONCACAF games were on Telemundo Deportes and Universo, so you were able to watch the CONCACAF games that way. But for the CONMEBOL games, the Peru-Colombia game especially, I mean, that was only on beIN Sports Connect. For those people who do have beIN Sports Connect, great. For those who don't, then you have to use Fubo, which crashed. Or use the beIN Sports Connect website, and that crashed too. So it was just an awful night in terms of for those who are trying to stream the coverage of whether it's CONMEBOL or CONCACAF. And because of the problems with the CONMEBOL games, that crashed Fubo and beIN Sports Connect for the CONCACAF games too. So it was just it was horrible, Kartik, and a really difficult night. And at the same time too, I think beIN Sports coverage of soccer in general.
I should say I had all kinds of trouble with Fubo last night, which again, this is the pitfall and downfalls of cord cutting. I haven't cut the cord, but I have cut the cord on beIN to where I reduce my cable bill by getting rid of channels of on tier 2 packages, right? I mean, I just kind of have the basic package, which includes NBCSN. So I get that and FS1 and FS2, but I don't get beIN. I don't get most of the other sports channels now from DirecTV. I was incredibly frustrated and was just eventually, will admit, I mentioned I had watched one of the games earlier in my thing. I eventually just switched to the match trackers.
Yeah. I mean, the online coverage was frustrating, but I'm also getting tired of BN Sports doing such a lousy job of promoting their own coverage of the games they're showing. They're working really inside a vacuum where they think if they run a promo on their TV channel, that's good enough. Everybody's going to know which games are on which channels.
Yeah, I actually had to check the program guide. I don't know. Those of you who follow me on Twitter probably noticed this on Monday morning or Sunday morning. I can't remember when it was that I went ahead and tweeted out their program guide, a link to their program guide, because I was getting so many questions about who they were showing, what they were showing Tuesday night, because they had the rights to everything, basically. The whole night they had the rights to in the ball and CONCACAF, and they had not answered any of those questions publicly. I guess they ran a few ads, as you said. I'm not even sure they did that. I was getting tons of questions about it and had questions myself, so the only way to know is to go to their website and check out the programming guide. Now, it shouldn't be that way, right?
Exactly. And in hindsight, I think BN Sports is probably wishing that they didn't have the rights to that Trinidad-USA game to broadcast, especially with so many CONMEBOL World Cup qualifiers coming down to the last game. And those games would have generated more viewers for them than Trinidad against US. You mean the Peru-Colombia game probably would have had much more viewers in terms of Spanish-language fans or English-language fans watching that game. So it was a bad night for BN Sports in terms of just being able to try to see BN Sports. Again, when I got home, I watched the rest of the game on Sling TV. The other issue, Kartik, I had, I know you watched the game on Universo, but the coverage from BN Sports was substandard. For a game of this caliber, I thought that Phil Shane and Kobe Jones did okay in the commentary. I thought Kobe was better than he usually is. But a huge issue. I mean, you had Julian Gonzalez, who was doing the sideline reporter there at the game in Cuba, I think the name of the city is, in Trinidad. But there was a delay. There was an audio delay of about 3 to 4 seconds. So Phil Shane would ask him a question in the middle of the game, like, so Julian, what's going on with Sunil Gulati? Like, what's he doing on the sidelines? And there'd be an audible 3 to 4 second delay, and then Julian would come in and say, "Oh, this is what's happening on the pitch or off the pitch," and that was really amateurish and really unprofessional. You would think that again, same thing that with the Honduras game, the same criticism. BN Sports should be sending the talent to the stadium. They didn't. So Phil Shane and Kobe Jones were calling the game from the studio. The other issue, too, was that it sounded like Phil Shane and Kobe were in a studio with a generator in the background. There was a lot of background noise. That didn't sound good.
I've noticed that on BN before. It's not the first time it's happened.
Huh. Yeah, it was just in terms of the whole experience. I mean, the game is, we'll get to in a minute, but the whole experience was poor. In the studio, we had Kevin Egan, who did a great job as always. You had Carlos Bocanegra, Jonathan Spector, and then Kobe Jones in the studio. And I thought that Carlos Bocanegra and Jonathan Spector especially were really lightweight in terms of their analysis. One example here was at halftime, after that first half, which was abysmal performance by the United States. The halftime analysis from Carlos Bocanegra was, he said, quote, "We need someone to come in for the start of the second half. Maybe Bedoya or Zusi or who knows who." And for somebody that you're paying to have an analyst come in, and he's suggesting to bring on Bedoya or Zusi or who knows who. Who knows who is not an accurate thing to say.
And suggestion. Actually, we could get into tactics later, but the fact that Bedoya didn't start and Nagby started ahead of him, and then that switch was not made, and Nagby was brought off, but you're already chasing the game, so you bring Dempsey on. I can't explain the tactics, but yeah. Bedoya would have been the right guy. Yeah, I agree with Bocanegra on that, but he should be more definitive and give the reason, which is because you don't have anyone to hold the ball and to free Michael Bradley to go forward and make plays because Nagby is so tactically deficient. You need that player. That player is Alejandro Bedoya, who can bring other players for the U.S. in kind of a selfless way into the match and change the way your shape is and change the way you're playing in midfield, but he obviously didn't make that very basic level of analysis that you need.
Yeah, and in post-match, Bocanegra was, he said he was almost speechless, which I understand in terms of being a former U.S. international and being so connected to the U.S. team. But in that type of, in that instance, you need somebody to be very vocal. You need someone to give some critical analysis. You need a Thomas Rongen, or you need a Craig Burley, or somebody of that sort who's able to actually digest what happened and to express his viewpoints.
ESPN has done this very well with Taylor Twellman and with Casey Keller in particular. We haven't seen Brian McBride in the last month or so, but he's usually very good too. In taking the former player's perspective but not being a company man and talking about the softness of U.S. players, etc. The difference here is Bocanegra right now is the technical director or the general manager of Atlanta United, an MLS club, and there is still a culture in that league that prevents you from speaking out and giving giving your opinions. And I've told you before on this show, Casey Keller, who I've mentioned repeatedly and was also in Orlando Friday night, he gets more shtick from the Seattle fans because he isn't a company man. And it's almost like you wonder when you look at Keller, is it worth it to speak out? Well, it's got to be worth it now after what's transpired. But Bocanegra, I didn't watch the end. But I would believe his coverage, and then that one, that of Jonathan Spector, who's a current player for Orlando City, is probably reflective of the culture in U.S. soccer, where you don't want to speak out because there are repercussions if you do. I can speak to that personally from my own experiences. There are repercussions if you speak out. It is as our good friend Simon Evans tweeted this morning, and he's obviously back in the UK now. It's a country club mentality. It's a small group of insiders who run U.S. soccer like it's a clique. And if you want to fit in with that clique, you don't criticize. Which is why Twellman has been on the outs with a lot of these people for a long time, I sense. Because, I mean, I don't know that definitively, but he's the one guy that has a prominent microphone. And I mentioned Keller, but Keller does local games. That has a prominent national platform and speaks out.
Well, let's get into that context. So one observation I found last night, too, was after the game. You mean, so post-match, the analysis from beIN Sports was extremely poor. But so you turned on ESPN and watched SportsCenter and saw, yes, Taylor Twellman.
Because I knew this is the way – the one thing you could say about ESPN, and it's usually with American sports, so I don't bother. But they're very dynamic, like a CNN or a MSNBC or Fox News, in that they break in if something dramatic happens, something important in sports happens. So they broke into regular programming and had Twellman and Max Brados ready and teed up.
Yeah.
And just 10 minutes. I know there's been a clip that's circulated now on Twitter and on Reddit of about 3 minutes. Taylor and Max went on for about 10 minutes, a good 10 minutes after the game, to the point where there's another publication. I was doing their post-game podcast for them, and I didn't call in because I was angry, and I'm watching Taylor, and he's firing me up more. And he said I think he spoke for the 95% of the fan base or the fans of soccer in this country that feel like they've been disenfranchised, mm-hmm, by the U.S. Soccer Federation. It was an epic rant, and I encourage everyone to, whatever clips are out there circulating, to find Brados and Twellman and watch.
I thought it was, at the same time, I thought it was eye-opening that we haven't heard anything from Fox yet. We haven't heard anything from Alexi Lalas or even Rob Stone.
Stone in particular being a guy who I'll compliment him. He did a very good job on earlier in the day with Portugal, Switzerland, and setting up CONMEBOL qualifiers, which were not on his network. But his tweets and his public defenses of the company men in U.S. soccer have been nauseating, to say the least, mm-hmm, through the course of the years, particularly the last few months. So I would love to hear from him. Love to hear from Alexi Lalas. And Alexi, do more than just put it on the players and say they don't have heart or desire or whatever fraudulent narrative you adopted a few months ago. The reality is, when Jurgen Klinsmann called out U.S. players as being unfit, which I believe is absolutely the case, they're not mentally fit to where they don't make mental errors late in matches. They're not physically fit to where they're intelligent in their movements late in matches. I think that's all obvious to a trained football observer who watches the U.S. men's national team. And this was 2 years ago, but when Klinsmann was still the manager, Lawless had this impassioned defense. Anybody who knows U.S. players knows that they're the fittest players, and they run around and they give more effort than anyone, blah, 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 blah. You know, all the company lines.
Yeah.
The reality is, we saw time and again mentally a lack of mental sharpness and tactical awareness from the United States in this qualifying campaign late in matches. So maybe Lawless owes not only Jurgen Klinsmann, but the entire fandom an apology for that rather absolutely wrong defense, and he got so indignant about Klinsmann's comments. Well, it played out that way. That was the thing I saw late in this match, that you had a U.S. team that really wasn't fit enough to push the issue, and we've seen that in other qualifiers. It's stunning because Lawless was giving a stereotype of the U.S. player in the 1990s and early 2000s, when you had guys that had to be sharper and fitter because there was a stereotype about American players, and they had to break a glass ceiling at European clubs. Harkes, Winalda, Reyna, Joe Max Moore, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Brian McBride. So they had to be fitter. They had to be sharper. But this is not the case with this generation of U.S. players. Yet Lawless felt like he had to defend the whole program. And that's just one example.
The tough thing about this, Kartik, is that we haven't talked about this yet until right this moment. But I think both you and I have seen this coming for a long time. In some ways, I'm not surprised at all. I was thinking, watching the game last night, I was thinking that in the last few minutes the U.S. would pull out an equalizer. I mean, just a kind
that's
of,
what I thought too. Yeah,
that it would happen. But as it unfolded, I was like, okay, I'm not surprised. I'm not shocked. I mean, I'm sure a ton of people out there were shocked at this. But we've seen this for, I mean, this is going back years, Kartik, but even back to the Gold Cup this past summer, in terms of the way that Fox especially hyped up this U.S. national team against B-team opponents, yeah, went all the way to the final, won the final, and they're talking about how great the United States is and how wonderful this is. And you and I and a lot of these listeners that are listening right now could see right through that in terms of the teams they were coming up against. It was a joke. It was a joke of the tournament.
This decline had started in 2010 after the World Cup, which the U.S. did pretty well and won their group, actually. And the U.S. had done well in qualifying. And I remember speaking to Richard Farley, our former co-host on this show, in early 2011, thinking the U.S. may not qualify for the following World Cup, the 2018 World Cup. Richard might deny he had that conversation with me then, but I remember that because we saw the youth ranks were bare. The U.S. was in the one period in the last 30 years where the U.S. wasn't performing well at the youth level. And the senior national team was beginning to show tremendous flaws in friendlies and in the Gold Cup in 2011. The solution was to fire Bob Bradley. Well, it wasn't really his fault. Maybe he shouldn't have been given a second cycle, right? You could argue you never give an international manager a second cycle. But this has been coming for a long time. And the performances of the U.S., even when they were winning matches, became less and less impressive through the course of the last few years, where there were less chance creations, less possession with a purpose, right? Less creativity in the final third. And all of that came home to roost last night because I thought after Pulisic's goal that, okay, the U.S. is just, they're going to push. Maybe Trinidad will have some, you know, fantastic goal line clearances, big saves, but they'll just pepper the goal. They'll be like Man City was against QPR when down 2-1. Man City, it was shot 43 and 44 they scored on in that game. And like shot 18 and 19 on target or something like that. Maybe not 18, like 12 and 13 on target. Instead, you had Trinidad almost take a 3-1 lead a minute later. Coward had to make a great save.
Yep.
On a breakaway. And then you had U.S. defenders really getting away with some cynical challenges because of last-ditch desperate defending. And that, again, I think is a fitness issue. Sorry, Alexi.
Yeah, plus after the first goal for Trinidad, there was the penalty call that should have been a penalty.
Oh,
so,
yeah, very clear.
I mean,
I think the referee didn't want to really influence the game and be accused of that. So the U.S. and to the recognition of to the credit of the U.S. players, they recognized that and they made some very cynical, desperate challenges when they were out of position. I want to remind our listeners before we go any further, this was a Trinidad experimental squad, a youth squad. Their best player, Kevin Molino, who to me is one of the most talented players in MLS, didn't even play in this game. He's the reigning MLS player of the week, by the way. Did not even play in this game, was on the bench. You had several other veterans for TNT not given a run out in this game because the TNT Federation wants to see what they've got with this next generation of players. A lot of them play in their domestic league. There are some MLS, NASL, and USL guys who played last night. There are also majority of the guys were guys that play in the Trinidadian League, which is basically an amateur league. It's a high-level amateur league if you're at certain clubs because they qualify for CONCACAF competitions, but it is essentially a semi-professional league.
One of the defining moments for me, Kartik, and probably most listeners probably may not remember this or may not share this moment, but for me in this game, I was just so shocked at how flat the United States was, how much lack of inspiration or determination there was.
Yeah.
But the one moment that I vividly recall is just, I think about 3 to 4 minutes to go in the game, the U.S. had a corner kick, and there didn't seem to be a lot of ball boys around in the stadium, but still, Michael Bradley kind of just was strolling towards the corner flag, and I'm like, why? Run, you get to the corner flag, take a quick corner, get in there, and he was kind of just strolling.
Contrast that with the urgency you saw from the Welsh side. Let's just compare the two sides you support, the two countries you're associated with. The urgency from the Welsh side at the end of that match in Cardiff. Now, of course, you're at home and they're being spurred on by that great atmosphere in Cardiff, but they were desperate. They were desperate to get one last chance. And Republic of Ireland was hanging on for dear life. Again, Martin O'Neill, tactical masterclass, which we've seen from him for years in English football and in club football. But just contrast the urgency, the desire, this comes back to us to a generation of American players who have been coddled, who have developed a sense of entitlement, and have believed their own hype because they're watching Fox or they're living in this protected cocoon of the U.S. soccer atmosphere. I have to say, two players for me that stood out as guys who wanted it last night: Christian Pulisic, 19-year-old, mm-hmm. and Tim Howard, who made some mistakes, right, and had a bad game, but still clearly was trying, 37-year-old. What about the guys between 20 and 36? Where were they?
Right.
Where was their head is more important.
Yeah, and Tim Howard, I mean, that first goal, the own goal was, I think, unstoppable. That was just a freak goal. And then the second goal was an incredible goal from Trinidad. And
I think the question marks about Howard came from the Trinidad should have had a third goal. He misplayed another free kick or another. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one was a free kick. And he was very fortunate, is the kind of consensus on social media, that ball, when it went off his shoulder, probably should have gone in the back of the net. And it ended up taking kind of a freak bounce, and he was able to clear it.
Yeah, which looked ugly, but I'm not a goalkeeper expert by any means.
Ultimately, he recovered.
He was able to stop the ball and get it away. I mean, that's the thing, Kartik. Actually, you missed the Be In Sports coverage last night, but during the broadcast towards the end of the game, Phil Shane mentioned, he says, some people have been calling for U.S. soccer to clean the decks, and which was exactly what you had said a couple of weeks ago, I think, on our Why the U.S. Soccer Media Doesn't Get It podcast that we talked about after the U.S. defeat, and how the U.S. soccer media in general, in total, were really very weak or very, very soft on the United States team and not critical at all. When you look at this U.S. men's national team, Kartik, there's so many issues to go through in terms of how the U.S. soccer is set up, from the youth playing levels, from the leadership within U.S. soccer. But if there is one biggest issue that you see that needs to be fixed, what would you say it is?
With the media?
No. Overall, the entire U.S. soccer program, in terms of is there one thing that needs to be fixed? That's
more, I guess, the one thing that needs to be fixed is, if there's one thing, it's having leaders that deal in some degree of reality and media that deals in some degree of reality. We saw once again this week the insecurity, the paranoia, the projection that somehow the U.S. soccer media and U.S. soccer hierarchy always has to self-justify. Okay, get your head out of that mode and start accepting reality, which is you had a good run, you elevated the sport in this country, but this is not a fluid thing. I mean, it's a very fluid thing. It's not a static thing. Things evolve. France had to retool. The Netherlands are having to retool now. Belgium had to retool. Germany, etc. You need to accept reality and not hang your hat on false narratives that you've created in order to make yourself feel better and more secure in the global football context, and accept that the U.S., for the hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the sport in this country, this is the thing that galls me. You can talk about population all you want, right? Mm-hmm. The reality is the U.S. has outspent its CONCACAF opponents, with the possible exception of Mexico, by infinite amounts of money on this sport specifically. It's not just about population and economic status and all that. It's also the spending within the sport in this country, yet you're getting beaten by these countries. You're getting piped to making the World Cup. You have to accept a certain degree of reality and stop saying, well, if European countries came to CONCACAF, they would struggle. Or, oh, if you look at our top players and European coaches don't respect American players, and that's why they're not getting the chance. And these sorts of kind of forced, insecure narratives. Oh, you know, we can't culturally accept German American players because there's a mindset of American players and Fabian Johnson and et cetera. They don't share it. Get your head out of your rear end with that stuff, okay? And stop parroting. This is to the media specifically. Stop parroting those insecure defenses that come from the likes of Bruce Arena and Sunil Gulati. I'll just finish on this. Sunil Gulati in 2009 talked about what a success Project 2010 was going to be, which said the U.S. could win the World Cup by 2010 because the U.S. was poised. Everybody kind of laughed at the statement. The U.S. was poised to make a World Cup run in 2010 and had a good World Cup. As I said earlier, they won the group. But no one actually called him on the comment. No one actually called him on, this is the president of U.S. soccer who is living in an alternate reality, equating the United States in his mind to the level of a Germany or Spain or France and Argentina or Brazil, when in reality the U.S. Is consistently struggling with the likes of Jamaica and Trinidad and Costa Rica and Honduras, et cetera.
Kati, I'll follow up with that with what Bruce Arena said post-match after the Trinidad-Tobago loss last night. And he says he was asked about changes, about making wholesale changes to improve this U.S. men's national team. And he said, there's nothing wrong with what we're doing. Certainly, I think if our league continues to grow, it benefits the national team program. We have some good players coming up. Nothing has to change. To make any kind of crazy changes, I think, would be foolish. We're building a consistent professional league. We have players coming abroad of a certain quality. There's nothing there. There's no excuses for us not to qualify for the World Cup. Well, I agree with him in terms of there's no excuses. I think it's just ridiculous that somebody at that level is I guess, parroting, is saying on message.
He knows about the league. Look, when he signed Nigel de Jong and Ashley Cole, and de Jong didn't really work out in this league, Ashley Cole did. Although the Galaxy have gotten worse, it isn't Ashley Cole's fault. Arena basically mocked the level of the league, saying, well, I know this league better than you do, and you're saying Ashley Cole's washed up. He's going to do fine here. Well, he's done fine. Mm-hmm. I think he's taken on a different hat. He made a lot of critiques that made sense about the league and the structure when he was felt like he had been jilted. He'd been fired by U.S. Soccer. He had proven his worth by raising the Galaxy to this very high level of. Obviously, he had Donovan, but basically on the backs of foreign players. Other than Jesse Zardes, the generation of really young players who came through the Galaxy Academy, the Jack McBeans, the Villarreals, et cetera, he didn't really give a shot in the first team, honestly, at the Galaxy, just from his own experiences. The thing I think that is important to recognize is there are significant countries who missed the World Cup. Okay, the U.S. isn't the first. France missed two World Cups in a row. The Netherlands missed the World Cup in 2002. Germany has never missed a World Cup, but they've struggled at Euros in the past. And it's how you react to those misses. Mm-hmm. And the recovery from it and the acknowledgement that determines how you do in the future. So do you recover? Do you make an effort to change the trajectory of the way you train and handle things? Now, don't look at England, because England has continued to double down on their mistakes. And maybe that's why they're always in a holding pattern. I know they won their group in Euro qualifying. We all know what's going to happen next summer to England, right? Mm-hmm. We can all pretty much predict that. Do you make the progressive change now so that you become a France or a Germany, or do you just wallow in this self-pity and self-justification? That goes back to my point, the self-justification, to where you end up being England or where Netherlands is now, or worse yet, end up as like Scotland. That is the doomsday scenario. You don't want the U.S. to end up like that. But if you have the wrong attitude, because the Scots, after getting eliminated in the 2000 playoff, right, against England, two legs, Paul Scholes' goal at Hampden Park carried it for England into Euro 2000. They had an absolute wrong attitude. And then they tried to fix it by bringing Bertie Vogts in, who culturally was the wrong fit. They had a decent qualifying campaign for Euro 2008. But other than that, it's just like deeper, deeper, deeper. There has been an unwillingness, I think, to put Scottish football at the forefront of some of the big clubs in Scotland.
Yeah, I think we're going to go into that holding pattern, because the election for the next USSF president is going to be actually in February. So so you might have Sunil Gulati running again, perhaps. Which sounds ridiculous, but you never know. But to me, it's that point. I'm interested to hear what Eric Rinalda has to say and what his plans are, if he is going to run for the board seat there, as well as other individuals.
I wonder if people take Rinalda more seriously now, because there seems to be this narrative, this underground narrative that's begun to circulate, from pushed by people in U.S. soccer and their media allies. Not the entire media isn't their ally. I don't want to give that impression, but they do have allies in the media. Some of the same people you saw manufacture excuses in advance of the Trinidad game without naming.
I think Rinalda,
they have said things, just to finish up, they have kind of characterized Rinalda as a malcontent and a guy who is desperate for attention, and that's why he's talking about this.
Yeah.
Continue.
I think a lot of people within U.S. soccer would fear Eric Rinalda because he would change things. He would shake up the system and change things from the top. I mean, the thing about Rinalda, if he does run, is he has to be careful about – it's going to be a political minefield for him to dodge around in terms of running a campaign for this one, because there are going to be a lot of people out there against him, probably a lot of people behind the scenes saying things about him to try to undermine him.
And I'll tell you how badly they try and undermine him. MLS, whenever Rinalda gives a speech, like at the NSCAA every year, or the Soccer Coaches Convention, as it's now known, National Soccer Coaches Association, they will plant people in the room to ask him leading questions because they're anti-Rinalda and they're paranoid about his appeal. Because when you go to the Coaches Convention, Chris, mm-hmm. which I do most years, Waldo is the attraction. I mean, there are more people wanting to go see Rinalda speak about the issues of the day and the game than to attend Bruce Arena's coaching clinic. Seriously.
Right.
I mean, he has a following, and he has a presence that scares the leaders in MLS and U.S. soccer.
With Rinalda, you do get real talk. You do get transparency. You do get honesty, and you do get fresh ideas. So whether it's him or somebody else is going to run for that presidency, it's a perfect timing in terms of everything that's happened to clean the decks, to bring in somebody new that has fresh ideas that's going to change up the system. Because as of right now, it's not working, and it's a disaster. And that's the thing, though, too. We've seen this coming for a long time. A lot of people have had their head in the sand. A lot of people use xenophobia in terms of just trying to kick out Klinsmann because they thought that he was the problem. And as we've seen from this, too, it was not Klinsmann that was the issue. It was the entire U.S. soccer system.
No, but we saw self-justification last night where people were beginning to put the blame again on Klinsmann. he got 0 points out of the first two matches. Okay, he played Mexico. That's a failure, the losing to Mexico at home. Losing in San Jose is something every U.S. coach has done. So that was a game that you look at the beginning of the hex, you're not going to get anything in Costa Rica. So you're basically minus three at that point, and you have eight games to make up that minus three. But there is still an effort, and there is some pushback. I've never been more popular on Twitter than I have in the last 18 hours or so since this result, 12 hours as we record this. I've gotten hundreds and hundreds of likes for my tweets, but there have still been those in the insider clique that have pushed back on some of the statements. Mm-hmm. And they always go back to the Klinsmann issue, because that they've ginned up this faux nationalism so much through the years that is their fallback position is, we brought in this German guy and he screwed it up for us. And which ended up being the narrative in Scotland. I don't mention Scotland just randomly. They brought Bertie Vogts in, who was actually Jurgen Klinsmann's mentor and who Klinsmann brought in to help the U.S. When he was the manager. And Bertie failed. But then it became all about, well, we brought in Bertie Vogts and it didn't work. And we're just going to double down on what we're doing. And Scotland hasn't qualified for a major tournament. Now it will be 20 years since their last major tournament appearance. So I don't think the U.S. will go that extreme direction. But, Chris, you never know. The Scotland example stands out there. And I don't want to sound like I'm fear-mongering, but if you're not shook up by what happened last night, then you're not living in reality. The Scotland example shines brightly as what could happen if you don't make the changes you need to make.
Absolutely. All right, Kartik, let's move on to listener mailbag, and we've got some questions that segue perfectly into what we've been discussing, and we can help answer those. The first one's from Ian Wallace through Twitter, and he said, I'd like to know how this changes the way Fox covers the World Cup. So to me, Kartik, to answer this one, in some ways, actually, it makes it better, which is a strange thing to say. But I think for anyone that's been listening to this podcast for a long time, you might agree with us. But when Fox does cover the U.S. men's national team, it becomes so much rah-rah USA that they often forget about the opponents, don't put much emphasis or coverage or time into the opponent, and it becomes a cheerleader festival. So with this, Fox is going to have to up their game in terms of their analysis with no U.S. national team. In terms of the commitment level, there's a possibility actually that with the U.S. not making it, there's a possibility that behind the scenes they might try to reduce costs. There could potentially be layoffs in terms of in different positions, or not sending as many people to Russia. I think 450 is what they said that they would do. That's a possibility in terms of behind the scenes, some things that we probably wouldn't see. But my input is that I think Fox will actually end up probably doing a better coverage of the World Cup because the U.S. is not in it, because they have to focus on the other teams by force.
Yeah, I had said that all along, that I thought that World Cup would be unbearable on Fox until the U.S. was eliminated. Well, now they're not even going, but they're going to have to retool their shtick, because, as you said, and this is the most annoying thing, this is the clear contrast between a guy like Taylor Twellman and a guy like Casey Keller and the guys that are on Fox. So Twellman and Keller and McBride and Herc Gomez, I think Herc Gomez just in general knows the region, maybe he doesn't have to do the research. But those guys try and cover the U.S. as opponents. They try and understand the U.S. as opponent. Sebastian Salazar, who I mentioned earlier, who I think is going to become a star if we get our heads out of our rear ends and deal in reality, because he's got such a cosmopolitan outlook on this thing. Seb Salazar, these guys, they spend their time covering the other CONCACAF teams, understanding them, and then dissecting what the U.S. needs to do when they play them. Now, Fox, even though so many of these guys in the other CONCACAF teams are in their faces, right? They play in Major League Soccer, the league they cover and promote and ad nauseum on that network. They don't spend any time, devote any resources or airtime to discussing those teams, unless it's Mexico. So they just have to retool how they present the U.S. men's national team. They have to be more objective in the future. And they're partly responsible for this, because the cheerleading that comes from Fox and the people in the U.S. soccer aristocracy or higher or royalty, if you will, that tell me privately they prefer Fox to ESPN, and that they're annoyed by things Taylor Twellman says, etc. Those people have again deluded themselves in a state of absolute lack of self-awareness, self-delusion, because they're believing what they see on Fox as well. And it becomes just this vacuum and this vicious cycle, which we have to get out of, which is why, Chris, if the Costa Rica qualifier, the one from Red Bull Arena, had been on Fox, I think the reaction would have been completely different. It was just that Ian Dark in the first half is basically saying, "Oh, U.S. is rubbish," and Casey Keller at halftime and Herc Gomez at halftime, like, well, what is this? We're getting played off the pitch. On Fox, the narrative would have been, we have more shots, we control more possession. I had someone cite that to me the other day about the Costa Rica game. Oh, the U.S. really bossed the game if you look at the metrics. It's like, well, what are you talking about? Costa Rica scored an early goal. That's what happens in any, even in other American sports. In football, in American football, if you get out to a big lead, the opposing quarterback has a ton of passing yards and more total yards because they're playing from behind. It's just logic. Exactly. But this is the point. There has been this effort with Fox in response to Ian's question. Sorry, I'm going on and on here, but to self-delude about the U.S. It's delusion. They need to snap out of it now, and maybe last night we'll wake them up. Maybe that's why we haven't heard from Stone and Lawless yet. They're doing some serious soul searching and realizing that their colleague Eric Winalda, who they have marginalized, has been right all along.
Yeah, the challenge for this one, Kartik, is that Fox has the rights for until 2026. So in terms of controlling the narrative and controlling the message, they've got the monopoly on it. For now through to 2026. So, I mean, a lot can happen in that time. But in some ways, I think Fox, they've been quiet so far. I mean, I'm sure they're going to come out and start talking maybe this weekend. But for them, this has got to be a huge shock to the system. I mean, the estimates are that the value of the rights for the 2018 World Cup have decreased by $50 million just based on the U.S. not making it to the tournament there. But let's move on, Kartik. The next one is from Jay Riddle through Twitter, too. He says, what does this all mean for World Cup broadcasters? And Kartik, I'll kick off on this one, too. And I think in many ways, we've talked about Fox, but the winner in this one actually is Telemundo Deportes. Because Telemundo now, you've got Mexico, Costa Rica, Panama, and possibly Honduras making it into the World Cup from the CONCACAF region. All of them are Spanish-speaking countries. Of course, it's going to hurt Telemundo and Fox, of course, but it's going to hurt Telemundo a little bit less in terms of the U.S. men's national team not making it. But they've got the Spanish-speaking countries there. And I think Telemundo is going to be the one that's going to be gaining the most from the World Cup next summer, while Fox is going to be trying to figure out how to boost the ratings in some other ways, maybe focusing more on the soccer rather than the cheerleading for the United States.
Yeah.
Next one.
That's the case.
Next one is from Ngoy from Twitter, and he said, "Bye bye MLS money, considering they are mooching off the U.S. men's national team TV deals." And he has a point there, Kartik.
Yeah, no, he has a very good point. I just don't know if the value of the U.S. national team package actually goes down with this failure, or if there will be some desire to keep. Well, I don't know. I mean, Fox and ESPN are both in financial straits. They I don't think they can afford to pay as much for the packages they have.
Right. I think it has to go down. I mean, in terms of the value for the U.S. men's national team TV rights, which are combined with MLS, they're commingled. So I think in many ways, I mean, the MLS deal currently goes from, 2015 to 2022. So it goes into the next World Cup. The next World Cup after this next summer's one. I mean, with the U.S., a lot of it depends on the next couple of years in terms of what they do, in terms of trying to boost this team, bring in a quality manager, bring in some quality leadership, have a stronger vision for this U.S. men's national team from the youth levels all the way through the entire system, have somebody to look at the way that the leagues are in the United States are structured. There's a lot of issues that need to be addressed. And I think in many ways, too, that this has got to have an impact on MLS, and it's going to have an impact on U.S. men's national team in terms of the TV rights value, as more and more people are moving to cord cutting anyway. But next one up is Sunny SoCal Rob 25 through Twitter, and he just gives a comment here, Kartik. He says, it's going to be very, very interesting which talking head becomes an expert on soccer in the coming weeks. And I think what he's talking about in terms of some of the non-soccer people, if you have a Colin Cowherd or who knows who from ESPN suddenly becomes an expert and starts talking about soccer and how the U.S. men's national team is a disgrace and a failure, it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, I already saw a tweet from Chris Fowler this morning, who I follow because of tennis and college football. But he's actually a soccer fan. He's a big Chelsea fan. I don't know how closely he follows the U.S. men's national team program. I know he follows Chelsea very closely. But I saw an interesting tweet from him this morning, so it certainly caught his attention, to say the least. So, but he doesn't have the platform. It would have to be one of those Cowherds or Whitlocks, one of those guys, Skip Bayless, someone like that.
Yeah. All right, moving on. This is in terms of what we discussed on last week's show, and this is from Dave Brunk, and he sent this in through Twitter. He says, well done, fellas. I am turning away from Premier League more than last season and watching Bundesliga. West Ham is behind the paywall too often.
Okay, I thought this was going to be the big topic of conversation this week, Chris, because I didn't realize the U.S. was going to crash and burn like this. But the response to our podcast last week, our featured topic, stunned me. Now, it's of course not a scientific sample. It's not. Maybe people are piling on because they see where it's going. But I don't know if you've even looked at my timeline. I had so many people tell me they've switched from from the Premier League to the Bundesliga this year because of either NBC Sports Gold or the lack of competitiveness of Premier League matches. Now, I don't know that we've seen that's it. Entirely responsible for the bump in ratings we've seen on Fox, but it could be. Still, there's far more people watching the Premier League in this country than the Bundesliga. Let's not pretend like it's not the case. But there's clearly a trend line, and I don't know. I'm kind of stunned, and I said that in my tweet responding to everybody. My general tweet was that I'm just stunned. I knew there was something afoot, but I didn't realize it was this massive or this widespread. And maybe, again, it's just a small sample size of the people who follow me on Twitter and interact with me on Twitter and interact with us on this podcast. But it's something NBC needs to at least be aware of, even if they're not making any change regarding it.
Well, let's jump around a little bit. We'll come back to the listener mailbag in a second, but I do want to go into the TV streaming news. And Kartik, the good news is that NBC Sports this weekend for the Liverpool-Manchester United match are going to be debuting a brand new commentator. Well, actually, he's brand new to NBC Sports, but he's not new to any of us in the United States, and that's Derek Ray. Derek Ray is going to be has joined NBC Sports as a part-time commentator, and will be commentating games now and again. So that's excellent news, and I think
It's the best news we've had in the U.S. soccer scene in a while.
Yeah.
I have to say I would almost prefer to see Derek Ray at Fox commentating on Bundesliga games because he has a unique expertise about that league that very few other people in this country have. But this is certainly preferable to the current alternatives at NBC.
And that's the thing, though, too. I mean, it's a breath of fresh air to have Derek Ray back and working for NBC Sports and broadcasting the Premier League. So I think this weekend he's doing the game with, I think, Phil Neville, and I'm sure he's going to be at the stadium. But the other thing to me is that with the U.S. crashing out, to me at least, I think Derek Ray would be perfect for Fox's broadcast for next summer for the World Cup, to have somebody who's very worldly, who's a professional at his game, who knows these teams, these players extremely well, and to have somebody with that confidence and that expertise to come in as a commentator is a must-have. So it'll be interesting to see if Fox goes that way.
Yeah, I also have thought about this overnight, whether Fox now is going to retool their American heavy lineup and go with some commentators and co-commentators that might have an expertise in the countries that are actually competing in the World Cup. If you were to hire Derek Ray, he has an unbelievable expertise on most of the European nations competing, and a thorough knowledge of South America as well. And unique perspectives. Now, part of the issue with Derek Ray, I think, and the culture around Fox Sports and U.S. soccer is that it's a culture of submission. He is a guy who very openly has been critical of various things. When he called New England Revolution games almost 20 years ago now, he was taken off the broadcast in favor, I think, of in favor of Adrian Healy eventually because of his critiques of management of Walter Zenga, of other folks. And then I think also you've seen him – we talked about Scotland a lot on this podcast. You've seen Derek Ray give the most articulate conversational pieces about the state of Scottish football and the mistakes that have been made. So if Fox wants to go in a different direction, he's the guy, but I don't know if they'll do that.
Yeah, I don't think they'll change it either, although they should. They should seriously consider it in terms of Fox Sports, looking at the talent that they're going to have as commentators. Without United States playing in the competition next summer, they really have to up their game. And to me, I mean, I think the John Strongs of the world will be fine. But you look at some of the other announcers or commentators that don't know the subject material as well and have been focusing mostly on MLS games or lower league soccer in the United States. You really need some experts to come in. So I wonder, we'll have to wait and see in terms of what Fox announces, if they go with a pretty much an all-American crew. To me, it should be based on experience and on quality, not on nationality. So moving along, Kartik, Dana Miner follows up, and Dana posted this on worldsoccertalk.com. And Dana says, I enjoy the podcast very much. I have a couple of things I want to touch on. I have pretty much stopped watching Premier League games. Leicester winning the league notwithstanding, the Premier League has become a plaything of a handful of oligarchs passing the title back and forth. As you guys said, the league is really two leagues, one league of six teams and the rest. About the Columbus Crew ratings and attendance problems, I'm a season ticket holder and have been for many years. Since Anthony Precourt took over as investor operator, the team has improved the fan experience 100% over how things were from when the Hunts were running the club. I put the running in quotation marks because they put the club on autopilot and were concentrating on FC Dallas. Early in the season, we were drawing abysmal numbers, about 12 to 13,000 in the stands. Fortunately, things have picked up as the season has gone by. But my friends are worried that Precourt and the league will begin to look around for places to move the team if things don't improve. What are attendance numbers like in other mid-sized cities? Last, I hate to be that guy, but I've been a Bundesliga fan since the Soccer Made in Germany days, so I have to let you know it's pronounced Hertha Berlin, and not Hertha Berlin, as I say.
And he's correct. And he is correct. let me respond to Dana on the he or she is correct. I don't know if it's a he or she. Let me respond to Dana on the Columbus possible relocation thing. I have heard various rumors that I've discounted the last 6 to 9 months about Precourt looking around at some of the mid-sized markets, which are either vying for MLS clubs now because they have USL or NASL clubs and looking to move up, or one or two that are haven't even applied in the in this next round of expansion, the 12 cities that have applied for four spots. Look, I still think you have a fan base in Columbus. I still think you have a soccer-specific stadium in Columbus, and you're in an era where it's very difficult to pry loose public money or to find a private investor and private land willing to help you out. So they can look around all they want. I think that team is going to stay in Columbus. That's my instinct. That's part of the reason I haven't bought into some of these rumors and zany things that I think people have given to me to float and hope I would tweet it or put it in an article when it's, you know, very much a trial balloon and those sorts of things. So I've discounted them. But yeah, those rumors are out there. But I have a lot of faith that the team is going to stay in Columbus.
And the last comment through the mailbag is from Paul, and he posted this on worldsoccertalk.com. He said, since its formation in 1992, the Premier League, as always, has always been a two-tier league with the same teams dominating the top four places. Occasionally, another team crashes a party. Blackburn champions in 1994-95, Newcastle runners-up in 95-96, to name two. But since the turn of the century, with the exception of Leicester City, there's been any one from three for the title and any four from six for the Champions League. The bottom of the Premier League is more exciting, especially over the last few years with newly promoted clubs not being automatic relegation teams. The Championship is more competitive and with a fullish bag of big clubs with a huge fan base. In England, more and more fans are turning to watching lower leagues. Even the non-leagues are seeing an increase in attendances.
Yeah, all true.
All right, so if you do have any feedback, questions, comments, you disagree or agree with anything we say, feel free to let us know. We'd love to read those out on air. The correspondence can be sent to us via email. It's web@worldsoccertalk.com. Twitter is @WSoccerTalk, or Facebook is facebook.com/WorldSoccerTalk. Now, Kartik, let's move on to the TV streaming news, and I'll have you kick it off.
Yeah, so we do have an MLS doubleheader this weekend on Fox on FS1, and this is and Fox Deportes also. Actually, this will be interesting because I love to see what the studio coverage is like. It'll be Rob Stone and Alexi Lalas hosting FS1's Whip Around coverage, offering quick turnaround highlights of in progress games, which is important because there's a lot on the line in terms of playoff races in the West, playoff seeding in the East. The East, all six teams that will be in the Eastern Conference playoffs have already been determined, which is a bit of a bummer this early with 2 weeks to go, but that's the case. Once the action begins on the field, Glenn Davis will call the New York Red Bulls versus Atlanta United match alongside Stu Holden, who has done a lot of work this week, as I said. Mark Folliwell, who has also done a lot of work this week, will call the Sounders FC Dallas match alongside Brad Friedel. At the same time, Rachel Bonanno is going to host a special digital whip around across Fox Sports, Fox Soccer's media platforms on Facebook and Fox Sports. Go beginning at 5:15 p.m. Eastern time for the Eastern Conference matches and 7:35 p.m. Eastern time on the Western Conference matches. This should be interesting to see if there is any sort of backlash in terms of interest in Major League Soccer following the U.S.'s elimination. Now, you could take the perspective, which I do, which is MLS is partially responsible for the elimination because the countries that have defeated the U.S. have a lot of players playing in Major League Soccer. But then you also could take the attitude that some fans now undoubtedly will, that, hey, you know, we're not good enough in this sport. I'm not going to watch it anymore. I'm not going to watch the domestic product anymore. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think it's going to hurt MLS TV ratings. I mean, for a few different reasons. One is that who wants to get excited about watching these players play for their club teams? But the other thing, especially after the performance in the World Cup qualifying, but the other thing you have to look at too, Kartik, is looking at people like Tim Howard, who was definitely declining, a sharp decline at Everton before he got a lucrative move to MLS. Michael Bradley, who was at Roma, had opportunities to train and play with some of the best coaches in the world, in Italy, decided to move back to Canada for a lucrative move. Josie Altidore was a failure in Europe, came back for a probably million-dollar deal in the United States. And then you had Clint Dempsey, who had the opportunity really at Spurs to really challenge for a spot and to raise his game, but decided to move back to the United States for more money and to play at Seattle. And I think in many ways, too, you look at these players, and in many ways, I mean, I can see what MLS was doing, trying to bring these Americans back home, raise the level of the game, increase TV ratings, and improve MLS as a result. But if anything, this actually ended up, I believe, hurting MLS. And hurting the U.S. men's national team.
Yeah, well, there's no question. Michael Bradley's move from Roma to Toronto FC, right in the prime of his career, hurt the player. I know I keep hearing these theories that you have to play in every game, and Bradley got to play in Toronto. Well, you know what? AS Roma, he's under Luis Garcia, who was the manager at the time. He's training with Totti. He's training with De Rossi. He's training with Struman. He's training with all these high-level players. And he makes that move 4 months before a World Cup, or 5 months before a World Cup. I think it was a calculated move by MLS to spend money to try and hitch their wagon to the U.S. men's national team in terms of marketing. It has failed. The cross-promotion between the U.S. men's national team and Major League Soccer has been – now, there are individual Major League Soccer clubs like Los Angeles Galaxy who market Gio Dos Santos and Vancouver who have marketed their Costa Rican players. But you have the league as a whole and even the league's website and their digital platforms basically commingling content with the U.S. Soccer Federation, serving as a propaganda arm, for lack of a better term, of U.S. soccer. You're right. It can't help ratings, right? There's nowhere to go but down when you think about that. And although the MLS ratings are almost in the basement already, but they've made the very bad tactical error of not separating their product, at least publicly, from the U.S. men's national team, and assuming that would always be successful, so you'll ride off their coattails.
Yep, and we've seen in numerous World Cups in the past, in terms of how many new soccer fans are created from World Cup tournaments, and how that boosts TV ratings after a World Cup tournament. And if you don't have the U.S. men's national team performing in that competition, and you've got players from La Liga, Bundesliga, I'm sure that the Germans will do well again, even from the Premier League, from England, etc. It's more likely that those TV ratings will get a boost as a result of seeing those stars play at the highest level. Now, before we close this podcast, Kartik, I do want to mention that we already have a few great articles at worldsoccertalk.com. We're going to have more coverage coming in the coming days, so definitely check it out. Some of the articles that are on the homepage right now include Fox Sports suffers $200 million hangover after U.S. fails to qualify for the World Cup. We've got an article by you, Kartik, that's talking about blaming Sunil Gulati for USA's failure, and in addition to the players and Bruce Arena. And last but not least, World Cup failure will leave U.S. soccer shell-shocked for years to come. Kartik, it's been a long podcast, but it's been a good one. Unfortunately, a lot of bad news, but I see this as a positive. If changes can happen, and if the right people can be in charge that know soccer, that can make change and have a positive impact on the entire United States. So, Kartik, where can listeners find you on the internet if they want to hit you up on social media?
KKFLA737, I think most of you already have. I see one of my tweets from last night is up to 1,000 likes, so that's pretty amazing. People are angry, they're acting out. You got to capture this emotion and remember this moment. Don't just move on a week from now and let the same things happen. As Twellman said last night, the definition of insanity is repeating the same mistakes over and over again, and that's how he characterizes U.S. soccer, and that's how I would characterize it. But I would take it a step further and say that there is a host of enablers out there. I think actually Twellman mentioned that too. And don't be an enabler. So you can find me on Twitter at KKFLA737, and we'll have lots of great coverage here at World Soccer Talk.
Okay, well, thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, Audioboom, and worldsoccertalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review. And Kartik Krishnaiah, on Twitter, you said, this is the tweet that got over 1,000 likes. It says, when a soccer culture depends on a national team, it's doomed to failure. Go out and support your local club. That's what really matters. And Kartik, what should they do?
I know it's tough right now for most Americans, but enjoy your football.